conflicting tendencies that one has can be held, then, according to Jung's model, and according to my own experience, something new will happen. Now that's where logic breaks down. That's where the scientific approach to the psyche really is no help. Because what happens is a new attitude. We have two attitudes in opposition. A man, for instance, wants to stay with his wife and he wants to leave her. They're two incompatible tendencies. Woman wants to go to school and learn something, and she wants to have a baby. She'll take all her time. At a particular time, these can be two incompatible tendencies in the personality. If one can hold on to the tension between those impulses, then something else happens, which Jung designated as the transcendent function, and it manifests as a new attitude towards both sides of the conflict. It often makes possible a realization in actuality of both impulses, but in a different way than formerly envisioned. You know, where often when a person is in a conflict like that, you have the impression that it's all this or nothing, or it's all this or nothing. That isn't necessarily so. What happens when this can be held, this situation, is what one can call an enlargement ego capacity. Now that what that means, an enlargement of ego capacities, we found awful. But what it means is that a person can't tolerate other ways of being other than one's own. It's at that point there is a total change in the conscious attitude, so that what was previously dismissed as different and therefore wrong can now be appreciated as different and therefore possibly of some value. Now that's especially evident at this point in an appreciation in each sex for the qualities of the other sex that he and she don't have themselves. You know, a lot has been written about androgyny, with that and hermaphroditism, that involves the total integration within one person of the characteristics of the opposite sex. So you have the masculine and feminine principle working harmoniously in a balanced state within one individual. Well, that's an interesting notion. And it's not as bad as an ideal. But in practice, what is required is the experience of one's contrasexual side in projection. And this can be a long process to appreciate what the other sex has that one doesn't. Now, for a man, predominantly, it's a matter of appreciating that just being is as valuable as doing. And for women, it's often a matter of appreciating that doing has its value too. And in the course of one's life, a man may have to actually experience what he's always experienced through his partner and vice versa in order to appreciate that they have some value. there's a transformation. And the whole process is really a process of transformation. So that ideally, after the outbreak of a nervous breakdown, one ends up, God knows how far down the line, with a personality that is more balanced and has integrated some of the things that used to dismiss in life and can move both into the outside world with ease and has a familiarity with its own inner topology, that is its own psychology. Now, I'm almost ready to stop here and go on with this in a more informal way through answering questions, but I wanted to mention something that seemed to me to reflect on a collective level what I've been talking about. When I talk about the conflict between ego and the unconscious, I'm talking about a conflict between two different attitudes. I mean, a personality that's rather straightforward and we can understand it. But the same thing can happen on a collective level. And probably many of you have read years ago The Sane Society by... what's his name? Eric Fromm, The Sane Society, where he talked about the real possibility of a society going crazy. Well, in many ways, what we're seeing today collectively is what we see in an individual clinically, when there is a breakdown in conscious functioning. So you have the world, virtually every nation on the verge of a depression and a recession, which can be seen as a regression of energy. And you have now the two superpowers making very warlike noises at each other. And the thing that impressed me the other day when I picked this up was a headline that read, that reads, "Tactics change in the U.S. as Reagan readies for World War III." Now, what this article is about is the preparation, as opposed to what happened in Carter's regime, where they were more or less quiet about these things. Now, Reagan is actively saying that it's very likely that there's going to be another world war and we want to get ready for it. Now, that makes a lot of sense. If there's going to be another world war, then you want to be ready for it. But what strikes me about this psychologically is that what Reagan and the extreme right wing in the United States, what they want is a solution to their own opposite. And on an individual level, that doesn't work. On an individual level, one has to live through the conflict and the tension with the opposite. And it seems to me that the same thing is true in the outside world. You must be able to tolerate the opposite and live through the tension that's involved and not seek an immediate solution. It seems to me that the fantasy of a world war that will solve the situation is just that, a fantasy. Because it will more than likely wipe out all possibility of conflict for anyone. So what this suggests to me is that the tension is unable to be held. Now, unless there are world leaders that can hold this kind of tension, then we're headed for disaster. And that was one of the last things that Jung suggested himself, that unless there were enough individuals who could hold the tension within themselves of the opposites, by which he meant the other side of their own individual personalities, then the world is bound to end in a nuclear war. That what we are able to do on a microcosmic level, that is in ourselves, is inevitably reflected by what happens in the outside world. Well, I'm going to stop now and see what questions you have. Thank you. Yes. Well, in terms of Jung's model, feeling is a value function, tells you what something is worth to you, as opposed to emotion, which has a physical innervation associated with it. Now, emotion in Jung's terms is affect only. It's not an emotional response. Emotion means or says that there's a complex working there. Now, there are such combinations as sensation, feelings. See, the problem semantically in our language is that we use feeling for so many things. We say we have a feeling about what the weather's going to be tomorrow, or about that we have a feeling that the Expos are going to lose the game today. That's intuition in Jung's model. Because intuition is not only what we can do with something, what the possibilities are, but he also describes it as a way of perception via the unconscious, as opposed to sensation, that is a way of perceiving the world through direct sensory contact, touch, smell, sight, hearing, and so on. But intuition, we know things, but we don't know where they come from. Yes.
Just on the same subject, you said one there's emotion, then you pointed to the complex. Would you clarify that a bit? Because what it sounds like to me was, if I have a beautiful rose, right, the last in my garden, I think that's beautiful. I have an emotion about it. Is that a complex? Do I have a rose complex?
I think behind that question, I hear the implication that if it's a complex, it's something bad.
That's what I want.
Oh, complexes are as common as roses. And no more or less harmful, but if you stick your finger on the thorn of the rose, you get a feeling for how the complex can also hurt. I mean, can cause problems. All I can say is that within these terms, emotion, an emotional reaction to something is 100% involved with a complex. But a complex is not necessarily awful. We all have, the complexes are the building blocks of the personality. It's how they operate in your life that is positive or negative. You know, if you get so involved with your rose that you stay up all night and nurse it in the garden, and you don't take care of your children or your husband or yourself, one could say you're rose complexed, all right. Yes.
The activation of psychic content, that there was a particular feeling.
Did you ask if a feeling type is more susceptible to neurosis? That a think, therefore a thinking type.
Right.
No, I don't think they're more susceptible.
I just thought that this particular feeling tone involved activation at step 3.
Okay, there's a confusion again semantically, because the feeling tone of a complex is an emotional tone. Okay, I can. I recall a dream of a man, 38, who dreamt that he was walking in a street that was like a canyon, and on each side there rose steep walls, buildings, and bouncing between these walls was a ball, and it kept coming towards him but eluding his grasp. And it was clear from the circumstances of his life, which I won't go into, that what he was experiencing through that dream, or what the message of the dream was pointing out to him, was that he had difficulty in holding on to, well, first of all, the ball, and then we look at the ball and we see that it's a symbol of wholeness. Difficulty in holding on to the ball means that one cannot grasp one's personality in its potential wholeness. That's what the transcendent function brings to the conscious personality. That capacity to grasp a vision, at least, of what it means not to be bouncing back and forth between two opposites. Yes. Well, everything would depend on what that person did when he found himself in a situation where he couldn't function, or at least where he couldn't function satisfactorily to himself. You know, it's not for someone else to say, look, you can't function anymore. This has to be a very subjective reaction to the world. Now, often it involves, the most extreme cases, it involves being hospitalized, but I'm really speaking about more, about less extreme circumstances, where someone realizes, for instance, that, well, this latest relationship that broke up, there must be something going on that I don't understand. You know, and then there is the possibility of change. As long as a person blames his or her problems on somebody else, there's no possibility of any change at all. Yes?
I think it was John Sanford who said that talking to a neurosis is talking to God. And I suppose you could then say
this.
So, comment on that?
Yes, well, yeah, that's a good question. And implicit in a lot of what Jung says, and I guess what I've been saying tonight too, is where does this impulse to wholeness, or what Jung called individuation, where does it come from? If there is something in the personality that is pushing for consciousness, that's what Jung called the imperative, the evolutionary imperative, and in another context, the psychological imperative in an individual, evolutionarily for mankind, so they don't destroy themselves in battles with one another. But for an individual, the psychological imperative is to realize one's own psychology. What is the motivating power behind that? Now, Jung called that the self, and it's what a theologian might call God. It's what primitives would call mana, malungu, some unknown power or force. However you describe it, it's what we've always, what mankind has always experienced as a force of the unknown that's been designated as God. An unknown factor that presses for meaning to one's life. Now, not some people have that pressure and some people don't. And no one has ever given a satisfactory explanation as to why that exists in some personalities and not in others. In Jung's model, it is the self that is behind that. It is the self being the archetype, not a concrete individual or anything, but an archetypal way of being that is the central ordering factor in the personality. Yes. Yes, I think that's true, particularly physical symptoms. You know, when one of the most common physical symptoms in a neurotic situation is a stomach upset. Now, the stomach has long been felt, beginning with early primitives and right through the Greeks, as the seat of the emotions. And often emotional difficulties just churn up the stomach. I've been through this myself countless times, and I think when these things are unattended to, they lead to ulcers. Yeah, so there's one physical symptom. Now there's a whole branch of psychology, and it's becoming much more widespread among Jungian analysts as well, to look at bodily symptoms themselves as a somatic expression of a psychic imbalance. Now that extends from kidney diseases to cancer. And as far as I know, in many areas of medicine, there is a growing awareness that physical diseases are not just associated with organic disturbances, that there's something psychologically going on. Now, specifically, one can often look symbolically at accidents or the physical symptoms that erupt. For instance, skin diseases seem to be a most common way of the psyche telling a person that they're in the wrong skin. That a person can erupt in very serious skin disturbances when they are involved in a situation where that is inappropriate to that person. Now that goes back right to the primitive belief that the skin is the expression of the soul. That through the skin, one's soul receives or is able to be expressed in the outside world. And one can look at different parts of the body too, symbolically, and in an attempt to get a handle on what's going on in the person's life. Yes.
Seemed that if one could have kept going, the regression wouldn't have been necessary. But the more I think about it, means that there are valuable contents in the complex, or valuable assets in the complex that can only be retrieved by the regression of the libido.
Well, it could be, but it's not something you can do consciously. Eh? It's something that seems to happen only when there is a sudden blockage, like a dam that a river is flowing through. And Jung does compare energy to a river, that as long as there is a free flow, there's no... there's no need to be concerned about the other side. When the flow of the river reaches the dam and then starts to back up, well, then those things are activated, because that dam symbolically would represent a situation in life that one could not negotiate because of the way one is, remember. Nothing necessarily to do with the outside situation. You get fired from a job, your wife goes with another man, your husband dies. These are outside situations that suddenly present a person with the situation that they have to adapt to. Some people can adapt more readily than others. But I should say that in general, life imposes on us a one-sided attitude because these are rewarded. You know, the stockbroker is not rewarded for a good feeling function. He may be rewarded for good intuition. So what we tend to develop one or two really good functions to make our way in life, and they work very well until a certain stage when something else is demanded. Yes?
How is this different from the notion of regression in service of the ego? Who coined that phrase? This looks to my memory, the French phrase, reculer pour mieux sauter.
Reculer pour mieux sauter, are you thinking of?
Well,
I don't know the other one you mentioned.
Regression in the service of the ego.
Regression in the service of the ego.
Perhaps somebody here in the audience.
I think that goes back to the Freudian, the psychoanalytic concept of the exhibitionistic grandiose self. That regression is back to inflating the ego to allow it to exist and erect more defenses. The other phrase you mentioned, the reculer pour mieux sauter, is a phrase that Jung uses in terms of the regression of libido going back to activate these contents in order that the personality may acquire the abilities and the qualities necessary to go back into the outside world. To go back in terms of progression of energy, because what is happening in a depression is the energy is no longer going forward. Now that's why Jungian analysts are inclined to counsel people when they are in a depression to go into the depression and not try to escape it. Right? A common popular view is that, oh, if you're feeling awful, go and see a friend or go to a film or something. But if you're seriously involved in trying to find out what's behind the depression, then you don't try to escape it, like taking a tranquilizer. You confront it, and you go into it and try to get a handle on what's going on underneath that is responsible for the depression. What is tying up your energy. And that can involve doing a drawing often, or doing some writing, or simply staring at the wall and seeing what images go by.
Last question.
question for both the question and I find this very descriptive and comprehensive. But from the standpoint of therapy, I wonder how you would evaluate the use of hypnosis.
I don't think I would even try to, because I'd have no experience with hypnosis. I know that there's a very interesting few letters between Jung and a Dr. Loy in volume 4 of his collected works, in which he talks about his original experience with hypnosis, and that he stopped it because although he had some success with it, he was more interested in getting at what was behind it than in being a medicine man who could just cure what he was looking at.
You probably have heard of Milton Erickson. It seems to me he had a very subtle way of getting through that step 6, the transcendental function.
Through hypnosis?
The resolution was on the part of the client. Erickson was an activator, so to speak. Sometimes he didn't know what was going to happen. Therapeutic was not accelerated.
Well, I can imagine situations in which you could be very helpful. But as I say, I've had no experience of it myself, either as a subject or using it. Yes?
If I understand you correctly, you're saying that this is essentially a purposeful, growth-oriented process if the person comes through it successfully. And it's set in motion by difficulty and adaptation. What would you say about a person who never experiences that kind of difficulty in adaptation so that they don't confront?
I'd say they're very lucky.
But then they don't get the outcome.
Well, I said this once before, but thank God everyone isn't neurotic. There are healthy personalities. There are people who meet difficulties and solve them in a mature way. They aren't plentiful. I'm sure they must exist. A lot, of course, you see, depends on how one interprets the difficulties that one does have. Because there are a lot of people who won't admit to any difficulties, but to any outsider, it's disastrous what's going on. That, I would say, signifies a rigid ego attitude that refuses to acknowledge any responsibility for what's going on in their lives and puts all the blame outside. That's a common phenomenon of projection. You know, that you experience your own chaos in the chaotic reaction of the outside world to you. Does that help that question at all? Yes.
You were saying that in the depression, you should face the depression and see what information is there actively, I guess, and try to see what's in there. Number 5, you know, when you're intimate holding the tension, you're trying to as well. Are you being passive there? Are you just waiting for something to happen? Or are you actively looking for answers? Or, is the active searching out of some sort of answer appropriate at that point?
Absolutely. It's what the kind of passivity I'm speaking about is von Franz calls in her fairy tale books passive reception. or passive receptivity. It's like the girl in the fairy tales who goes up into the tree to wait for the dawn. Now that can, I'm sorry to say, take years. The sun just refuses to come up. If we think of the sun in terms of consciousness of the situations in life, it's often a waiting process, both for a man and a woman. Yes.
Is there an average time between number one and number eight?
No, I wish there was. It would make things a lot easier. You had a question.
How would you say that the aspect of love enters into number five, the conflict between the ego and the unconscious? And is that, in fact, what you would say is responsible for the transcendent function? Or how does love fit in?
To the whole model. Well, love's terrific. It seems to me it fits in everywhere.
Okay, but in the ego or egoless aspect, there's...
Well, if you have, I'll be more serious about your question. If you have a personality that is entirely bound up with its own needs, what might be called a narcissistic personality, and does not see the outside world as other, then you have a situation where it's not possible to love. Then you have a situation where you have to have your needs fulfilled. That's commonly called love. I don't think that's love. And circumstances reveal in the course of such situations that this is not love, but it's dependence. Now, real love acknowledges two things: the difference between somebody else and oneself, and the need for some distance between those personalities. So you have the difference between a symbiotic relationship that's, you see, in mother and child, where it's healthy and necessary for later life, and you have the same kind of relationship in grown-ups, where it's quite unhealthy and creates constant tension, because the integrity of the personality demands that this situation stop. Each person in that situation is depending on the other to fulfill his or her needs. That can't, by any stretch of the imagination, be called love. Now, do you want to go on and ask me something else about love?
Can love cause transcendence?
I think that love is a consequence. The way I think of love, anyway. You see, that's a very hard question to answer, because love has such an emotion with it, and it creates such an impression of well-being and oneness with both the partner and the whole of life. Enthusiasm. Well, that's a good feeling. I have nothing against it. Whenever I've experienced it, I've really loved it. No, not in this more technical sense. No, the end process of what in the East is called Tao, and what Jung calls the individuation process, is an experience of oneness with the world and other people. And that's to be distinguished between the what is the beginning of the process, that's identification, where you don't know there's any separation. The end of the process is where you know there's a difference, but you still feel that empathy that it can identify with and experience what others are feeling. But I wouldn't call it love at that point, except in that, what's the Latin term, agape, maybe that form of love. Earthly love is much more banal. Yes.
Can you describe a transformation again, elaborate on what the state or the transformation of is it a condition or a state or is it, how does it relate to the original?
Well, no, it's just a result. It's a change. It's the end result of what has happened during the process. Just another word. See, by transformation in this term, it means a change in the quality of the complexes. And what I said about the rose about the complexes being healthy and not disappearing, that's true. But they can, in effect, be depotentiated. That is the energy that is associated with the complexes that manifest as an emotional reaction to certain situations can, by being consciously understood, be transformed so that although the complex is still there, it no longer has as much power as it did. You know, so you don't blow up at your mother. You can walk away. You can outwit the complex. That may be necessary. There's something happens that we call transformation to change the situation. And then the next thing that happens is that energy starts going back in terms of progression again. Well, I think I'm going to stop now. And there is... some refreshments. There are refreshments next door on the upper floor. Thank you. That's very much.